The Radio Memories Network is brought to you in part by Liberated Syndication. Podcast publishing made easy. Libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome again to the Radio Detective Story Hour. If you have a particular radio detective you want to hear, or if you just want to comment on the podcast, feel free to leave a comment on the website or email me at otrpodcast@gmail.com. Tonight I begin an hour-long podcast that will focus on probably the most famous detective ever, Sherlock Holmes. Holmes, as most people know, was the fictional creation of Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle explained how he created the character and the influence of Dr. Joseph Bell.
With regard to Sherlock Holmes, I was, when I wrote it, a young doctor, and had been educated in a very severe and critical medical school of thought. Especially coming under the influence of Dr. Bell of Edinburgh, who had most remarkable powers of observation. He prided himself that when he looked at a patient, he could tell not only their disease, but very often their occupation and place of residence. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance.
With the popularity of this Holmes story, Doyle would go on to write many of them, but eventually tiring of the character. His solution was to kill Holmes off in a story called The Final Problem. But there was such a hue and cry from his devoted readers that he later began writing more of the stories. Ironically, the first great interpreter of the English detective was an American. William Gillette was born in 1853 and eventually became a stage actor. He also began writing plays and pastiches in which he himself would play the starring role. In 1899, with Conan Doyle's permission, Gillette adapted Sherlock Holmes for the stage. It was Gillette who created many of the characteristics we associate with Holmes today, including the deerstalker hat, the meerschaum pipe, and many others. It was also Gillette who set the standard for interpreting the character. On October the 20th, 1930, the Master Detective Holmes and his sidekick chronicler Dr. Watson solved their first mystery on the air. That mystery was called The Speckled Band, and Gillette spoke into the microphone from the special glass curtain stage of the National Broadcasting Company's Times Square studio. Gillette was over 70 years old, and so the following week, Holmes was portrayed by English actor Clive Brook, who had previously appeared as the famous detective in a film in 1929. There were some radio recordings in which Gillette appeared as Holmes, including a Lux Radio Theater from 1935, but only a clip of his voice exists. Here is William Gillette, at 80 years old, interpreting Sherlock Holmes.
I merely refer to this in case you should see fit at some future time to chronicle the most important and far-reaching piece of work in my entire career. The case of Professor Robert Moriarty.
Moriarty? I don't remember ever having heard of that fellow.
The Napoleon of crime. The Napoleon. Sitting motionless like an ugly, venomous spider in the center of his web. But that web having 1,000 radiations and the spider knowing every quiver of every one of them. And within 48 hours, we'll have the lines drawn so tightly around him that he can't move. We'll arrest him and his entire gang.
My Holmes, this is a very dangerous thing.
My dear fellow, it's perfectly delightful. My whole life is spent in a series of frantic endeavors to escape from the dreary commonplaces of existence.
This is a recording from a play called Sherlock Holmes, specially recorded in 1936. The adapter from written word to radio play was Edith Meiser. She was instrumental in bringing Sherlock Holmes to radio, having convinced NBC to allow her to create a radio series. Over the next 13 years, she continued to pour out scripts based either on the Conan Doyle stories or from her own imagination. Meiser chose to avoid the usually sound effects-heavy play production and set about creating scenes with less physical action and violence, and instead opted for moodiness created through character interaction and dialogue. Let's listen to the earliest known existing episode of Sherlock Holmes from January 18, 1933. Richard Gordon stars as Holmes with Lee Lovell as Watson. Gordon would go on to portray Holmes on radio at least 95 times. Listen to how Meiser has built up mood and anxiety through music, minimal sound effects, and dialogue.
Every week at this time, the makers of G. Washington's Coffee bring you a story from the Sherlock Holmes series of mystery dramas. This week's adventure is an adaptation of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's story entitled The Final Problem. Remember as you listen to it that G. Washington solves your daily coffee problem just as surely as Holmes solves his famous mystery. At the end of the program, we have a brief announcement about Dr. Watson and his friend Sherlock Holmes. Please listen for it. And that opening paragraph, as always, leads us to Dr. Watson's comfortable, hospitable study.
Where there's a blazing fire and a steaming cup of G. Washington coffee to welcome you. Here it is, Mr. Bell. Made it as you came up the steps.
Thank you, Dr. Watson. You know, a good cup of coffee always seems to me to be the very essence of hospitality.
You name me a better coffee than G. Washington's, Mr. Bell. Go ahead, name me one.
Ah, but seriously, G. Washington's isn't just another brand of coffee. It's really entirely different. It not only has a perfect flavor, but it's the easiest coffee to fix. Just a teaspoonful in the cup, add hot water. Incidentally, you never make more than you're going to use, so that makes it economical, too.
Right, Mr. Bell. Now, suppose I begin my story.
Fine. What's it to be this time?
How about another tussle between Holmes and Professor Moriarty?
Excellent. Always gives me plenty of first-class shudders to meet that individual.
Well, tonight's story deals with Holmes' efforts to break up one of his most unpleasant schemes. A racket, you call it today.
And did he succeed?
Oh, now, Mr. Bell, that's putting the cart before the horse. The affair began with a series of curious disappearances from St. Anthony's Hospital.
Well, what disappeared, Dr. Watson? People or things?
They were corpses, or perhaps I should say cadavers.
Oh.
No, before I go any farther, perhaps I should explain that St. Anthony's is a medical school and hospital combined. I myself took my course in anatomy and dissection inside its venerable walls. Sir Lionel Greatlake, the head of the staff, was an old friend of mine. We cursed our internship in the same hospital. But to make a long story short, I received a frantic communication from Sir Lionel begging me to persuade Holmes to come straight to the hospital. I remember that night perfectly. A particularly nasty pea super had settled down over London. Literally feeling our way, we crept along the embankment till we sensed, rather than saw, the gray walls of St. Anthony's looming up ahead. Foghorns always have to sound so mournful.
Well, Watson, you would insist on coming tonight.
No, the staff entrance should be somewhere along here. And here it is. I stumbled over the doorstep. Where is that infernal bell? Oh, and here we are. I hope the night watchman hasn't gone off in his rounds.
No, someone's opening the door.
That you, Watson? The fog, I can't see very clearly.
Oh, it's me right enough, Leo. I brought Sherlock Holmes along with me.
Oh, thank heavens, but come in.
Holmes, this is my old friend, Lionel Greatlake.
Ah, delighted.
Honored, and I may say grateful and relieved. This is the sixth theft inside of a month, Mr. Holmes. It's got the place in an uproar. Nurses having hysterics, patients insist on going home.
I take it you're alluding to the cadavers which have been stolen recently.
Yes, Mr. Holmes, you know how jealous a hospital is of its reputation. The least little breath of scandal...
Oh,
and...
cheer up, Leo. Maybe it's just a prank of one of the lads. You know what medical students are.
No, that's what I thought when we found the first body missing 4 weeks ago. But now that five have been stolen, oh no, that's carrying a joke too far. They tried to get away with another this evening.
Really?
I just happened to drop into the dissecting room in time to stop it. The minute I opened the door, I knew someone was in there, but he slipped out the side way before I could light the gas. But come and see for yourself. Follow me. The laboratory is in this wing.
Almost, Liam. Looks familiar, Leo. Remember when we used to sneak a forbidden smoke behind that broom closet?
I wish to heaven life were as simple nowadays. Deuced face is like a beehive, buzzing with suspicion. No wonder we've been able to keep it out of the papers. Here we are. One second till I unlock the door. That's it. Now, just let me turn up the gas. Well, there we are.
Quite impressive. I see you have all the latest improvements. That gentleman in the corner, I take it he was the object of tonight's attempted abduction.
Yes, Mr. Holmes, that's the corpse. Splendid specimen, too.
Face a bit the worse for wear. Well, otherwise, a splendid body.
Yes, we're most anxious not to lose him.
He must be fairly recent. I see there have been no injections of the preserving fluid.
That's right, Mr. Holmes. He died only this afternoon.
And the other stolen bodies, they have been duly preserved, I suppose.
Well, no. Now that you mention it, they were all stolen before being treated.
Curious, eh, Watson?
Well, I don't know. I suppose if you're going to be a body snatcher, you might as well take fresh ones.
You'll pardon me if I rummage around a bit, Sir Lionel?
Oh, of course, of course.
Yes, I can carry on my interrogations and my investigations at the same time. My lens needs polishing. Now then, male or female?
What?
The stolen bodies, were they male or female?
Oh, male, all of them.
You don't say. Interesting, eh, Watson?
You mean you think the thief's a woman hater?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as that. What age are the missing corpses?
Oh, I don't know. Middling, I should say. Remarkably good lot of bodies, though. No marked defects, I mean.
Here's a lad who's been careless about cleaning his instruments.
Oh, that'll be Potter. Has some girl on his mind. Can't wait to get washed up and away.
I see. And you found this specimen out here after the thief was scared off, eh? I take it the cadavers aren't usually left lying about.
Oh, certainly not. They're kept in that long steel cabinet over there. Can't be too careful, you know. Have to be rats in a building as old as this.
And here, how many people have keys to that cabinet, Sir Lionel?
Only Dr. Lacey. You may know him by reputation, Mr. Holmes. Hugo Lacey. He's our head surgeon and has charge of the classes in dissecting.
Of course, brilliant fellow. I say, Leo, how's he coming along with his experiments in transplanting tissue?
Can't say. Carries on most of his experiments in a little laboratory he's fixed up in his own lodgings. Never lets anything out till it's perfect. One of the cleverest surgeons in the country, Mr. Holmes. Magnificent touch. I could wish, however, that he was a better professor.
No good at teaching, eh?
No, it isn't that. It's his temper. He can be devilish nasty. And let him catch one of the lads with an instrument bent out of place. It's a phobia with him, Mr. Holmes. A place for everything and everything in its place. I trust young Potter sets his things to right before Lazy sees them.
Oh, this is the door through which the thief escaped, I take it.
Yes, I bolted it on the inside, as you can see.
Well, that's that. I think I've seen all there is to see.
Found anything, Holmes?
Yes. There is what you might call an overabundance of clues. Too many to permit of any intelligent deductions.
What do you mean?
Well, 14 sets of fingerprints, for instance. And in the dust, under that operating table alone, I found shreds of 5 different types of tobacco.
Dear me, I'm afraid Mrs. Platt is getting careless again. Oh, she's the cleaning woman, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Lacey is always complaining that she's inefficient. Well, Mr. Holmes, if you've finished your investigation, perhaps you can advise us how we should act in this matter.
Now, before I do that, suppose we come to an understanding. Would you be satisfied merely to stop the thefts, or do you want to know who is responsible for the missing corpses?
We must find out everything, Mr. Holmes. Who and what and how and why. A mystery of any kind is most demoralizing for a hospital.
Well, in that case, we should do nothing further.
Oh, but Holmes...
We shall do nothing further tonight.
But aren't you going to set a watch on
if
his
room? If we did, the criminal wouldn't show up. You may take my word for it, Sir Lionel. The man who has been stealing your cadavers is thoroughly acquainted with the workings of this hospital.
Look here, Mr. Holmes. If we don't set a guard on this room, he may steal this body, too.
I sincerely hope so.
Well, no use making things too easy for him. At least we can put the body back in the cabinet.
Unfortunately, that won't be possible. We can't open it. The cabinet has a spring lock. The thief slammed it after him.
Oh, dear. What will Lacey say when he finds this corpse out here in the morning?
Well, I don't think there's much danger of that, Sir Lionel.
Really, Mr. Holmes, I'm disappointed. I must say I hoped you would be more helpful.
Well,
There's one thing we can do for you before we leave, eh, Watson?
No, Watson.
Well, we can make up for Mrs. Klutz's deficiencies. If you'll get us a couple of old rags and Lionel, I think Watson and I can go over this room in no time.
Oh, have you gone out of your mind?
Not at all, my dear Watson, not at all. It's most important that everything should be neat and tidy. Seems to have dissipated all the fog.
Now, what's the idea of routing a chap out of his nice warm bed and the streets still deserted? It's depressing, if you ask me.
The important thing, my dear Watson, is in setting a trap is to collect your catch before anyone else does. Oh, here's St. Anthony's. Hello. Sir Lionel seems to be having a bit of an argument with someone on the steps.
And I'll be put off the schedule by any poor detective, you see. I'm going home now to fix Dr. Lacey's breakfast, but I'll be back. And when I do, I'm going to clean that room.
But Mrs. Cuff, I assure you.
Fine one you are to be put in charge. Everyone knows routine is what keeps an officer running.
Watson, Mr. Holmes, I didn't see you. Come in.
Watson, Anthony's come at you, I'd like to know. Oh, give me away, you.
What? Here, I beg your pardon.
Why, I'm not to be put off his schedule, I'll tell you that. My soul, what I've
seen. That was Mrs. Clark.
So I gathered.
Bit of a termagant, eh, Leo? Red hair, fairly blazes.
Well, come in. Sorry to give you such a stormy welcome, but I just caught Mrs. Clark about to clean up the laboratory. I suppose you want to take another look at the place.
If it's convenient.
Yes, of course. Follow me.
I wonder why the sudden burst of energy on Mrs. Clark's part.
Dr. Lacey may have been putting the screws on. They get along like cat and dog, those two.
But didn't I just hear her say that she was going home to fix him his breakfast?
Yes. You see, Dr. Lacey is Mrs. Klutz's star lodger.
But surely if they get on each other's nerves, as they seem to...
Yes, it's a bit difficult to understand, I admit, but... Oh, I suppose Lacey hesitates to move. He's really very comfortable. He's built in a lot of improvements, cupboards and things of that sort. And I've told you how he is. A place for everything and everything in its place. Moreover, Mrs. Klutz is a first-class cook, and Lacey, he's a good feeder.
Father Lacey, I wouldn't push the old girl too far. I'd be afraid of finding poison in my coffee some bright morning.
Well, here's your laboratory, Mr. Holmes. After you, gentlemen. Looks about the same as it did last night.
Well, I shall be able to judge better after I've gone over the place with my microscope.
You said yourself there were too many fingerprints and things.
Well, why do you suppose I insisted on those rags last night, eh?
Oh, of course, I see now. We were rubbing out those prints.
Oh, marvelous, my dear Watson, marvelous. The old brain is actually functioning this early in the morning. Well, now let's see what we've bagged. Here's the sweeping stroke of a mop. The very mop that has been standing in this corner. Here. Here are the imprints of a heavy hand on the edge of this table. Note the unusual walls on the left-hand middle finger, like a question mark.
Those must be Mrs. Klutz's fingerprints. She was just about to start dusting the table when I caught her.
Yes, the prints on the mop and on the table are identical. Well, that seems to be all the evidence against Mrs. Klutz.
I got her out as quickly as I could.
Holmes, the corpse. It's gone.
I wondered how soon you'd notice that. The corpse has been stolen. But what did you expect, huh?
Sorry to contradict you, Mr. Holmes, but the corpse has been put back in the cabinet.
Oh, indeed.
Yes. As a matter of fact, it slipped my mind. I should have mentioned it sooner. Seems Dr. Lacey dropped in late last night and insisted on putting the cadaver back in the cabinet. Nothing the night watchman could say would dissuade him. I told you about his mania for order last night, Mr. Holmes.
These are doubtless his fingerprints, then, here on the lock and around this panel of the cabinet. Yes, typical surgeon's hands. Long, sensitive fingers, but strong. Tips slightly specialist.
Yes, that's Lacey, right enough.
But, Holmes, aren't you going to look inside the cabinet?
Well, I suppose we might as well if Sir Lionel can provide us with the key.
Certainly. Lacey left his with the night watchman. Here we are.
By Jove, the corpse is missing.
Yes, I gathered it might be. Well, now let us see if we can find anything further in the room itself. Here we are. Prints of a third set of fingers. Yes. He came in here earlier than Lacey. And notice the fingerprints of the doorknob. First this individual, then Lacey, and finally, Mrs. Klutz. All nicely superimposed, one over the other.
See, Holmes, this is fascinating, almost as exciting as a scientific experiment.
Yes. This third individual, and not any too steady. Here he stumbled and had to put his hand out to brace himself.
There's a knife print here on the wall. He moves over to this jar of alcohol. He removes the cover. Then he puts it back again. And here he staggers out.
You mean he was intoxicated?
Beautifully.
Yes, but I don't understand. Why in thunder did he come poking around here in the middle of the night?
Well, Watson, have you no recollection of your own green salad days? Didn't you ever sneak a bit of laboratory's alcohol to help out a celebration that had suddenly gone dry?
One of the students, eh? Any idea which one is the home?
Well, I think I can make a guess, but I don't intend to. The boy isn't mixed up in this body snatching. The corpse was here when he left. His prints are under Lacey's on the doorknob.
What is it, Potter? Oh, I just thought I'd slip in and polish up my instruments before old Petticoat gets... I beg your pardon, sir. Before Dr. Lacey gets a look at them. I'll come back later.
Well, not at all. Come right in. We're just leaving.
Yes, but Holmes, we haven't discovered anything
yet. We have. We know for sure that either Lacey or Mrs. Klutz is involved in this business. Possibly both. Yes, sir. I suggest we go to pay the Klutz menage a visit.
Well, I'll be glad to take you over myself. Potter, you look a bit fagged this morning.
I'm all right, sir. A bit liverish, that's all.
Well, don't let it get you down. Come along, Watson.
Oh, Miss Potter.
Yes, sir?
Well, they tell me tomato juice is an excellent antidote for raw alcohol.
Mrs. Klutz's place over there, the house with the white shutters.
Look at that crowd of people standing gawking out in front. I say, looks like something's happened.
Yes. There's my favorite watchdog of the law, Inspector Lestrade of Scotland Yard, standing in the doorway looking important. Hello, Lestrade. What's up, eh?
Plenty. A woman by the name of Klutz has just murdered her lodger, Dr. Lacey.
Well, I told you she'd do it someday.
Any unusual details?
No, open and shut case. First, she stabs him with a kitchen knife, then she throws the body, clothes and all, into a vat of nitric acid this bloke was keeping in his dressing room.
Indeed. Any objections if I come in and take a look around?
All right. But I tell you, this case is open and shut. But come in. Body's in first room, head of the stairs. It's not nice, but if you want to look, go ahead. I gotta stay here.
Oh, thanks.
What a vile odor. Mm-hmm. Chemical smell, plus something else.
Oh, that'll be the acid. Look out, stairs are dark.
Holmes. You hear that noise? Like something bubbling and frying?
Yes, that's the acid, the working on the body.
Of course, that smell is acid and fat dissolving.
Right. There's this much of the room. Oh, good morning, Jenkins, good morning. The Lestrade set you here to guard the body, eh?
Yes, sir.
Hey, this air...
Jenkins, I think you might open another window. Get a draft through here.
Yes, sir.
Now, Watson, if you'll bring me that jug labeled olive oil, you may as well stop the action of this acid.
You're right.
Yes, sir. Pour it right into the tub. Mrs. Lestrade said the remains are not exactly attractive. I wonder, Sir Lionel, if you could bring yourself to identify Dr. Lacey. Well,
certainly, Mr. Holmes. I'm a medical man. I'm quite used to...
Yes, it is
rather horrible. Face almost entirely eaten away. With the dark hair, what there's left of it, and the clothes, and that ring, he never could get it off his little finger. Yes, I think we may safely say that it's Lacey, poor devil.
Well, Jenkins, how was he killed?
Kitchen knife on the table there. Mrs. Klutz's fingerprints plain as day.
So Lestrade's been persuaded the value of fingerprints, eh? Dear, the world does progress. Yes. These are Mrs. Klutz's prints, all right.
Hey there, Joe. Lannan
is here. Bring Mrs.
Klutz
along.
Why didn't you go and get your hands off me? I didn't kill him. He was dead when I come in. He was dead,
I tell
you.
None of your
lip
and get going.
Lestrade, just a moment. I'd like to ask this lady a few questions.
He was dead when I found him. Is it likely I'd have called in the police if I did anything?
Oh, you called in the police.
Well, that she did. Leaning out the window screaming bloody murder.
Oh, any idea who could have killed Dr. Lacey, Mrs. Klutz?
No, sir. I gave me no all night. On account of my sisters having a baby, I went straight from her place to the hospital.
Oh, you had any chance to check up on that, Lestrade?
Oh, that's straight enough, but she'd been home at least 20 minutes before she called the police. Time to murder half a dozen doctors.
I didn't do it, Lestrade.
Now, you know, Lestrade, it's just possible that Mrs. Klutz may be right.
Huh?
You see, it would take several hours for acid to dissolve the corpse as far as this.
What of it? Her fingerprints are on the knife? That's enough for me. Hers and no one else's.
And why shouldn't me fingerprints be on that knife? It's my own kitchen knife, ain't it?
Well, that knife, suppose you look at it again.
Now, what in blazes good?
Now, notice the order of the fingerprints, for instance. Thumb and forefinger near the blade end of the handle. Now, suppose you take this pocket knife of mine and pretend to stab me with it.
Now, this is just a lot of... All right.
There, now, you see? Notice the way you hold it? Thumb against the outer end, little finger next to the blade. In other words, the grip for using a knife for kitchen work and for stabbing are exactly reversed. Dr. Lacey was not stabbed with this knife at all. It was put here by someone to incriminate Mrs. Klutz.
Yes, but if she didn't do it, who did?
Someone who wanted to get rid of her. You any idea who that could have been, Mrs. Klutz?
No, sir. That I haven't. The only person mean enough to do a thing like this is that son of a gun, Lacey. And he's dead now, Lord rest his soul. Oh, dearie me, it's not bad enough having a murder in my own house and then losing my best lodger. But the police have to go accusing me on top of it all. Like as not, I'll never get another tenant at these rooms. Oh, dearie me.
And all that is so much froth, my dear Mrs. Klutz, compared to the real danger you're in.
What's that?
The murderer. He's still at large. And he isn't exactly fond of you. I think I'll just drop in from time to time to make sure you haven't been murdered in your bed.
Mrs. Klutz is in danger.
Obviously, Watson. Obviously. Confounded. Why didn't she answer the bell? If anything's happened, and... Oh, yes, yes. Here she comes.
Oh, good afternoon, gentlemen. Please to step inside. I'd have come to the door sooner, but I was upstairs cleaning out Dr. Lacey's suite. Would you believe it? I've got a tenant.
You don't say, you don't say. Well, does he know its history?
Yes, sir, that he does. But he says he's not superstitious.
Oh, how fortunate. What's he like?
Well, he's a German. Professor or something. Come here to carry on some experimenting with Dr. Lacey. Dr. Lacey told me he was expecting him only last week. And so when he come asking for Lacey this morning, and I told him what had happened, right away he asked if Dr. Lacey's notes and instruments were still here. And when I said yes, he said he'd move right in and carry on where Lacey left off. Would you mind coming upstairs while I finish my work?
Well, lead the way, Mrs. Klutz, lead the way.
He's a nice-looking man, too. Blonde, with a beard. He limps a little. Oh, it'll be a relief, I tell you, after that, Lacey. He was getting queerer and queerer going out at all hours of the night. I declare I was on the verge of telling the police to keep an eye on him more than once. Well, here we are. Just you sat on the sofa. Now, what in the name of...
Well, from what I can see out the window, I should say that your new lodger has arrived.
Thanks, preserve us. Excuse me, gentlemen, when I let him in.
Holmes, anything we'd better be going?
In a moment, Watson, in a moment. Plenty of time.
This way, please. Look up at the turn of stairs. Oh, my, ain't it hot? Oh, Mr.
Holmes, Holmes.
This is Herr Glutz.
Professor Glutzfader, Mr. Befehl.
How do you do?
Delighted. Sorry I had come all this way and find a friend dead.
He is no friend. He is what you call a colleague. Mrs. Klutz, the portmanteau on the bed, please.
Yes, well, I know Mrs. Klutz will make her comfortable. I trust you had better luck than Dr.
Come, Watson, come. We must be going. You see, Professor Glutzfader, we were the detectives on this case.
Don't you have found?
Nothing, I'm afraid, nothing. These are my notes on the case. I'm really rather ashamed of them. Would you mind if I burn them here in your fireplace?
Oh, not at all.
Thank you. Oh, dear me. I don't seem to have a match.
One moment, I'll get you some here in the drawer at this table. Ah, here you are, a nice little box.
Thank you, Dr. Lacey. Huh? I thought you would know where to find them. A place for everything and everything in its place. Yes, I was sure you would be drawn back to these rooms.
Me? You think I am Dr. Lacey? He is dead, murdered.
No, that wasn't Dr. Lacey in that tub of acid. It was one of the bodies he had stolen from St. Anthony's. It had a rather curious conformation of the bones of the right foot. I had seen it the night before, so of course I recognized it. Your misfortune, Dr. Lacey.
Bodies, foot, sir. What is all this rubbish?
Well, you see, it came to my attention not long ago that Professor Moriarty was getting in touch with quite a number of heavily insured businessmen. One after another, these men died. But by and by, the insurance companies became suspicious. I was told to investigate. I discovered that on several occasions, Professor Moriarty had called on Dr. Lacey. Dr. Lacey, who was experimenting with facial surgery. Dr. Lacey, who had access to any number of corpses from St. Anthony's. Well, in time, I began to suspect that Dr. Lacey was working on these dead bodies and transforming them so they would look like the gentlemen who wished to collect their insurance. Professor Moriarty made a handsome profit, I believe.
Unfortunately, though, I couldn't prove my theory.
Kavashnik, it is crazy. No one would believe it.
Oh, so I found.
Ah, then what good does it do you?
Just this. When you're in prison, the whole scheme will fall to the ground.
But I am not Dr. Lacey. You have no proof.
There you are wrong, sir. This little matchbox which you just handed me contains all the proof that I need. On it is a set of fingerprints, which is identical with some on the cabinet door in the laboratory of St. Anthony's. And those fingerprints are known to be Dr. Lacey's.
Holmes. It's magnificent.
Elemental.
Phenomenal.
Elemental, my dear Watson, elemental.
And that's the end of the story, Mr. Bell.
But Dr. Watson, didn't the man ever confess?
He did better than that. He offered to show up Moriarty, but when they came to take down his testimony, he was found dead on his prison cot. Obviously, more of Moriarty's work.
Well, there's one thing I don't understand. Why didn't he take the same way out as the businessmen? Surely he could have doctored some corpse up so it looked like himself.
He could have, Mr. Bell, but that's where human nature comes in. He hated Mrs. Klutz, so he wanted to implicate her. It was his big mistake.
Well, that certainly is a fascinating story, Dr. Watson. Now to get back to something where there are never any mistakes.
I know what you're hinting at now. Another cup of G. Washington coffee.
Yes, indeed. Dr. Watson, have you ever stopped to consider how much the word economy has come to mean to Americans during the last couple of years?
It's come to mean more to me, too. I have to save on a lot of things I never thought about before.
How do you do it, Dr. Watson? Does it mean giving up all the good things in life and using cheaper quality?
Not at all, Mr. Bell. I still keep to the good things, but I'm a little more careful how I use them. More satisfaction in being a little careful with good things, you know, than in putting up with poor quality. Oh, by the way, Mr. Bell.
What is it, Dr. Watson? You're chuckling over something now, and it's only fair to tell what it is.
Well, a lot of people have been taking a lesson from Sherlock Holmes, Mr. Bell. They've been drawing deductions.
About what?
About my book of Sherlock Holmes stories, Mr. Bell. They've been observant enough to notice the little number one on the back of the volume, and they want to know if they're going to be other books with more stories in them later on.
I'm afraid I'm not very observant, Dr. Watson. I never noticed that little one. And are there going to be more stories?
I can't tell for sure, Mr. Bell. I've been talking it over with Mr. Washington. But just in case there are, I want everybody to get volume one right away, so they won't be left when the first edition runs out and be unable to make up their complete set.
That's right, too. We'll have to warn them about that. Especially with that economy we were talking about. It's worthwhile getting a really good book for nothing. Well, what about G. Washington? Is that economy?
Of course it is. You know Sherlock Holmes' story about the rich old mustard manufacturer, don't you?
I know, Dr. Watson. I can't say that I do.
Well, it's a good story. It applies to saving money on coffee, too. It seems a smart young man, who thought he was smart anyway, asked the mustard king if he really made all his money out of the little bit of mustard people use on their food.
And what did he say?
He said no. That he made most of it out of the mustard people leave on their plates. And that's just the way it is with coffee, or ordinary coffee, anyway.
You mean the real expense is not what you drink, but what you waste?
Exactly, and that's where G. Washington saves. There's no waste. You only make what you want, and yet you can have all you want.
Well, that sounds like economy, all right. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Watson and I want you to test G. Washington economy. Get a 4-ounce can right away. Don't be afraid of the size of the can or the price. G. Washington is economical because it ends waste. And as a special inducement, why, Dr. Watson will give you one of his books of 7 Sherlock Holmes stories. Just print your name and address on the back of a label from your 4-ounce can and send it to Morristown, New Jersey. You will receive, without cost, a handsome Deluxe book with a gold profile of Holmes on the cover and a picture of Dr. Watson as a frontispiece. In that way, you'll have the satisfaction of proving to yourself that G. Washington's won't wreck your family budget and of getting a handsome book of Sherlock Holmes stories for nothing. Please note down the address, Morristown, New Jersey. And send in that 4-ounce can label right away so you won't be left without Volume 1 if the good doctor persuades Mr. Washington to wish him Volume 2. Now, Dr. White, what about next week's story?
Well, next week I'm going to tell you the story of a man 20 years older than his bride and how death came to Rose Hill.
And now, in answer to numerous requests, we want to announce that the Sherlock Holmes program has been on the air for 3 years. The part of Sherlock Holmes is played by Richard Gordon, that of Dr. Watson by Lee Lovell. Neither Mr. Gordon nor Mr. Lovell play the part of a detective and his doctor friend in any other program.
outside of the serialized Holmes, there appeared in 1938 a single radio production of Sherlock Holmes starring the boy genius Orson Welles. Welles was only 23 when his Mercury Theater produced a version of the Conan Doyle story over CBS. Welles lightened his voice, playing Holmes very much in the manner of Gillette and Gordon.
Since my marriage 3 years ago, Holmes has continued to occupy the Baker Street lodgings by himself. And here almost every afternoon when my work in the office is finished, I am in the habit of calling on him. The sitting room as you go in is exactly as it has been for the past 13 years. The worn bearskin rug, the huge sofa covered with faded chintz, the mantelpiece cluttered with miscellaneous objects, unanswered letters and piles of loose tobacco. On one side of the fireplace, in a deep armchair, his pipe curling forth slow wreaths of acrid tobacco, draped in his hideous purple dressing gown, sits Sherlock Holmes with his violin under his chin.
Come in. Oh, Watson, my dear fellow.
How are you, Holmes?
I'm delighted to see you, perfectly delighted. Upon my word, I am, but... I'm sorry to observe that your wife has left you.
She has gone on a little visit. But how did you know?
How did I? Well, I like that. How do I know anything? How do I know you've been getting yourself very wet lately, that you're an extremely careless servant girl, that you've moved your dressing table to the other side of the room?
Holmes, if you had lived a few centuries ago, they'd have burned you alive.
Such a congregation would have saved me a great deal of trouble and expense.
Tell me now, how did you know all that?
Too simple to talk about. Scratches and clumsy cuts, my dear fellow, on the inner side of your shoe there, just where the firelight strikes it. Scratches, cuts. Somebody scraped away crusted mud and did it badly, badly. Scraped the shoe along with it. There's your wet foot, my dear Watson, and your careless servant girl all on one shoe. Face badly shaved on the right side, always used to be on the left. Light must come from the other side. Couldn't very well move your window. Must move your dressing table.
Of course. But how the deuce did you know my wife was away?
Well, where the deuce is your second waistcoat button, Watson? And what the deuce is yesterday's buttonniere doing in today's lapel? And why the deuce do you wear the expression of a...
Oh, marvelous.
Elementary, my dear fellow, elementary. The child's play of deduction. I'm only doing it for your amusement before we pass on to more serious matters.
Oh, what is it now, Holmes?
Watson, my dear fellow, the enthusiasm which has prompted you to chronicle, and if you will excuse my saying so, somewhat to embellish my little adventures... You occasionally seem fit to introduce a certain element of romance which struck me as being just a trifle out of place. Something like working an elopement into the fifth proposition of Euclid. I merely refer to this in case you should see fit at some future time to chronicle a case on which I am about to embark. The strange case of Professor Robert Moriarty.
Moriarty? I don't remember ever having heard of the fellow.
No, Watson, you haven't. It is precisely this quality of invisibility that makes of Professor Moriarty the Napoleon of crime. Sitting motionless like an ugly, venomous spider in the center of his web. But that web having 1,000 radiations and the spider knowing every quiver of every one of them. And within 48 hours, I'll have the lines drawn so tightly around him that he can't move. I'll arrest him and his entire gang.
My Holmes, this is a very dangerous...
My dear fellow, it's perfectly delightful. My whole life is spent in a series of frantic endeavors to escape from the dreary commonplaces of existence. For a brief period, I escape. You should congratulate me. The day before yesterday, I received in this room the visit of a certain foreign nobleman who has recently inherited a very considerable title and who is about to be married. Seems that this titled gentleman was so indiscreet as to fall in love with a young English lady by the name of Faulkner, socially his inferior, and... to make her a promise of marriage. Later, at his family's insistence, the thing was broken off, and the young lady died shortly after of a broken heart, leaving behind a sister. Also, considerable evidence in the form of letters, photographs, and jewelry with inscriptions. These the sister kept. These, together with the sister, are now being held in a house in St. John's Wood by a pair of blackmailers who go by the name of Chetwood. So far as you see, my dear Watson, a fairly ordinary case of blackmail, hardly worth my attention. Last night, upon my inspection, a certain element revealed itself which renders the case far more important than I had expected.
And that element was...
Professor Moriarty. Come in.
The amazing thing about the Welles broadcast is that he was only 23 at the time. And not only did he star as Holmes, but he had adapted the play as well. His Watson was Ray Collins, who appeared with him in Citizen Kane, who was nearly 50. Interestingly enough, the voice that Wells used to introduce the show, his own, I suppose, natural, slightly actorish voice, was deeper and darker than the voice he used in the actual play itself, in the adaptation. This was light and smooth, not unlike a young James Mason, and he spoke brightly and quickly, as though this was a method of establishing his brilliance as a detective.
While there were many actors who portrayed Holmes over the years, the Holmes that some considered definitive, probably more so by his longevity than his interpretation, was Basil Rathbone. Rathbone was to Holmes on radio what Jeremy Brett was to the television version. He tended to create a more manic, depressive character, a fanatic to the deductive process of investigation. Rathbone first came to the character in the film Hound of the Baskervilles in early 1939. A second film appeared slightly later that year with Rathbone again as Holmes. The popularity was so enormous that he and Nigel Bruce, who was Dr. Watson in both films, agreed to a radio version beginning in October 1939 over NBC Blue. Rathbone's performance was probably the golden period for Sherlock Holmes on radio. At the same time as the radio version, Bruce and Rathbone continued to star in a series of filmed stories which continued to be very popular. But in 1946, Basil Rathbone feared he was being typecast in the role, and so he left it. The new radio Holmes was given to Tom Conway, who had portrayed the Falcon in films. Conway's portrayal was smoother and more polished.
Well, Mr. Holmes, I think you'll agree my suspicions were well-grounded.
Yes, and we'll lose no time investigating this matter. I think we may work faster if we divide our forces. I shall return to the inn and compose a telegram that I shall ask you to send for me, Lord Manvers.
Of course, Mr. Holmes.
Aren't you going to Ponsonby Hall, Holmes?
Not immediately. However, you, my dear Watson, can be my advance guard.
Me?
Yes. I think that your open countenance, combined with that delightful Scottish accent you sometimes assume, plus an appropriate name, should lull Dr. Ponsonby into believing that he has another wealthy customer who needs his very specialized services.
Well, Holmes, I'll do my best. Just the same, I'll be very relieved when you get on the scene.
Conway only stayed with the role for one season. Over the next 3 years, listeners would hear from three other actors portraying Holmes: John Stanley, George Shelton, and Ben Wright. In 1950, after nearly continuous broadcasts of Sherlock Holmes on radio for 20 years, Holmes would leave the U.S. airwaves. As with other radio programs, dramatic radio was losing out to the power of television. But where U.S. dramatic radio was dying, it continued to thrive in England, and beginning in 1952, the U.K. would broadcast almost continuous episodes of the Conan Doyle character with Carlton Hobbs and Norman Shelley as Holmes and Watson. Another series would also air with John Gielgud and Ralph Richardson. While there was a Sherlock Holmes version on radio in South Africa and Canada, I am not aware of any in Australia. If you know of any, please let me know and I'll make a correction on a later podcast. I'm going to end tonight's look at Sherlock Holmes by playing clips from the various actors who portrayed Holmes after Tom Conway. First, we'll hear from John Stanley.
Altogether, he was in no sweet temper.
Matches, matches, where are the matches? Look at that confounded fog. What happens to all the matches in this house, I'd like to know.
Oh, my dear Holmes, why not use the tongs and a live coal if you want to relight your pipe?
I burned myself.
For heaven's sake, Holmes, stop spluttering. I say, something's annoying you. Why don't you get it off your chest?
It's that latest book of yours.
Hmm?
Sensationalism, Watson, rank sensationalism. You're always placing the emphasis on the crime. Crime is common. Logic is rare. You should stress the logic. You've degraded what should have been a course of lectures into a series of tales.
Now, really, Holmes, that's not logical. You're always complaining that crime is falling off. You say there are no first-class criminals left.
Quite. And therefore, if you depend on the crime to hold your readers, you'll soon be a back number. Criminals. They've lost all their enterprise and originality. My practice seems to be degenerating into an agency for recovering lost lead pencils and giving good advice to young ladies from boarding school.
Advice to the lovelorn, eh?
Well, look at this. This note, it came in the Morning Post. Yes, the last straw, that's what it is. Here, read it.
Jimmy, let me see it.
Following Stanley was actor George Shelton.
Well, Holmes, up at last, then.
my dear Watson. Yes, I had in me the makings of a pretty fine loafer.
What do you got there, Holmes?
Oh, this? A chance for you to make some money.
Eh? Well, don't keep me waiting, then.
Have you ever heard the name of Garrideb?
Garrideb?
If you can lay your hands on a Garrideb, there's money in it.
Soon see about that, then. Ah, here we are. The London Telephone Directory. Now, what's it all about, Holmes?
Oh, that's a long story. Rather a whimsical one, too. I don't think in all our explorations of human complexities we've ever come across anything more singular.
Gaffney, Gazer, Gamage, Gennett, Gapgore, Gallagher. Ah, here you are. Garrideb. N. 136 Little Rider Street West. Well, what now, Holmes?
Is he the only one?
Yes.
Then I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Oh.
That's the man who's written me this letter. We want another to match.
Confound it, Holmes. I wish to
come in.
The last clip I'll end with was before Tom Conway and is of the definitive Holmes, the great Basil Rathbone. Here is a clip from the first series on radio in which he appeared.
I found them in the drawer of Hugo Oberstein's desk. Read them.
The Daily Telegraph agony column. The first one says, too complex for description, must have full report, terms agreed to, payable when goods delivered. Signed, Pirro. Pirro, indeed. Sounds like a Mardi Gras.
Now, read on, Watson, read on.
Second goes, matter presses, must withdraw offer unless contract completed. Pirro again.
And the last, dated Monday, the day the crime was committed.
Monday night after 9, two taps, payment in hard cash. I say, do you think it was a submarine that the plans that he was buying?
I'm almost positive. And Pirro was Oberstein himself. But we'll find out for certain this evening. I've invited the gentleman who sold the papers to meet us.
But how? I don't understand.
I inserted this advertisement in today's Daily Telegraph. Tonight, same hour, same place, two taps, vitally important. Your own safety at stake. Signed, Pirro, as usual.
By George, if he answers that, we've got him.
Unless we're too late. Come along, Watson. There's no time to lose. You can take this package for a change. I've been carrying it around all day.
What's in it?
Oh, just a jemmy, a dark lantern, a chisel, and a revolver.
Nice equipment for a respectable citizen to be carrying about the streets of London, I must
say. Yeah, you know, Watson, there are times when I suspect we aren't quite respectable. Here we are. This is Caulfield Gardens.
Thank heavens, it's still foggy. I shouldn't like to be caught in the act of housebreaking.
Yeah. Oh, this wall, Watson. There's a window we can easily pry open in the back.
Scale that wall?
Oh, come on, hurry up, hurry up. There's no time to lose. Here. I'll give you a boost. Come on, up here. That's it. Look out, here I come.
I must say, Holmes, you're as agile as a cat. It's uncanny.
This is the window. Light the lantern and give me the jemmy. One. Two.
Holmes, the underground runs right past here, almost on the level of these windows. I could have reached out and touched it.
Yes, quite convenient, wasn't it? It was here the body was placed on the roof of a train. Look out of this, look on this windowsill. You can see the soot is blurred where they rested the body. And here, look. This brown stain is blood.
Nasty, Holmes. Let's get on to the house.
Very well, then. Come along. The window's open. Easy, don't break the glass.
Supposing Oberstein should happen to return home.
Well, we must take our chances in this business. Come along, Watson, come along. Our visitor will expect to be let in by the front door.
I wish these stairs didn't squeak so.
9 o'clock. We can expect him at any moment now. You take your position on one side of the door. I'll be on the other. So we can pounce on him when he enters. I'll throw my greatcoat over his head.
Well, I wish he'd hurry.
Shh, Watson.
What if he doesn't come?
There he is. Ready now. I'll open the door.
You wanted me?
No, you don't. Take that.
What the hell?
Easy, Watson, easy.
All right, Holmes, I've got him.
Well, let's take a look at our catch. Take the overcoat away, Watson.
Right.
If you have any comments about this particular podcast, please leave them on the website. Next week, I'll be looking at a husband and wife detective team from a series that was just recently placed into circulation after being absent since they first aired. Goodbye. Well, that takes care of another Radio Detective Story Hour for this week. Remember, you can contact me about this podcast at otrpodcast@gmail.com. That's otrpodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we'll have another great radio detective story for you. Until then, this is Jim Widner. Good night.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' Run? The coffee? Is it the coffee or the $1 donut or $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese that you can add to it? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' Run. $3 offer available on sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich only. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Offer valid on medium or larger coffee. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer terms apply.